Good evening, everyone. As just said, I'm Rabbi Glass. I'm the rabbi here of the Adam Street Shul. Previously, I worked for ORA, the Organization for the Resolution of Agunot. I actually worked for them in two different jobs. The first time I was their graphic designer. I like to think there was some recalcitrant husband somewhere who gave a get because he was so moved by my typographical choices of the posters, but that was unlikely. But then the year before I moved here to be the rabbi of the shul, I was an assistant director of advocacy, basically one of the people who tries to help people get their get. Obviously, the entire topic that we're going to be discussing, which is the Aguna crisis. It is one of the greatest tragedies facing the Jewish community as a whole. It does not just affect the Orthodox community, though it predominantly affects the Orthodox community, because there are plenty of instances where, for whatever reason, and I'm not going to get into those reasons, but there are several situations where non-Orthodox Jews still, for whatever reason, want a get through an Orthodox Beit Din, and they too can fall under the category of Aguna. Basically, the Aguna crisis is caused by Jewish divorce law. Unlike a lot of secular legal systems, which only require what's often called unilateral no fault, if just one member of the marriage decides they no longer want to be married, and there need be no particular reason for this, there need not be any fault. One of the members can decide, I just don't want to be married anymore. And in the eyes of, you know, secular courts of law, this is, you know, good enough reason to move legal proceedings to start the divorce process. In Jewish law, in contrast, for reasons we are going to see today, Judaism requires mutual consent. It's not good enough for just one member of the relationship to want a divorce. Both parties, both the husband and wife, need to agree to the divorce. And what this means is that in a situation, and I'm going to be referring generally to agunot and treating as though a female, though do realize there's a small but nonetheless percentage of men who cannot have their get accepted by their wife, but generally it's an issue facing women trying to leave marriages. But in a situation where the woman wants to leave the marriage, the husband says, no, I'm not going to give you a get. That is a situation of igun. Literally, it means chained. The wife is chained to her marriage. In the eyes of secular law, she may still be divorced, but in the eyes of Jewish law, she remains married. And that creates not only, obviously, several psychological issues, still remaining married to someone you don't want to remain married to, but fundamentally, in the eyes of Jewish law, if you are married, any sexual relationship that woman then engages with, she's going to be an eshet ish. It's going to be an affair. And most significantly, should she have a child when she is still an aguna, that child is going to be considered a mamza, which is about as bad a situation as you can possibly create. And so this is not just tragic because we have people unable to leave their marriages, which is tragic in and of itself, but the ramifications, the issues that are further caused by situations of igun, makes it an even more of a disturbing and problematic situation. The term aguna is a borrowed term. Classically, an aguna was a woman whose husband had disappeared overseas, and there was no record of whether he was alive or dead. And so it could be that when traveling overseas, he could have died, or alternatively, he could have just picked up and left, and there you go. And so Chazal were uncertain, is this woman still married or not? Therefore, she was called an aguna, she was chained. Generally, those situations do not exist anymore, but we borrow the term to refer to a woman or a spouse who's unable to exit their marriage because they will not receive their get. Generally, by the time we get to an aguna situation, the reason the spouse is refusing to give a get is in order to perpetuate the abuse, which also adds to a psychological element here. Generally, especially when ORA starts to get involved, and we're going to be talking about ORA in a lot more detail in one of the latter weeks of this series. Generally, by the time ORA gets involved, by the time we really declare this an aguna crisis, chances are there's already been abuse involved in the marriage. Often what is happening is the husband is refusing to give a get, his wife wants to leave the marriage because she's being abused, and he wants to perpetuate the abuse. Other reasons for wanting to keep control of the get is to basically gain an added bargaining chip in the divorce proceedings. Obviously, you know, the judicial system, whichever judicial system, whether it's Jewish law or whether it's secular law, will divide the assets, and the husband may decide he wants an extra bargaining chip. This is a problem when he's trying to get the rights to something that is unjust. So the An extreme example, but unfortunately not extreme when you deal with the kind of situation, and warning, I'm about to tell a horrible, horrible story, but here goes with that warning. One example of this kind of situation was a case that Ora dealt with where the wife had walked in on her husband raping their daughter, and now he is holding the get back because he wants unsupervised visitations of his daughter. Obviously, the courts themselves won't allow that to happen, but nonetheless, it's not just bargaining chip. It's often being used in order to gain things that no one should ever be entitled to. And so Aguna brings with it, the Aguna crisis brings with it, you know, this spousal abuse element, which is very often present in, there are the odd situation, it's true, where one of the, you know, the husband has not yet come to terms with the fact that his marriage is over and still wants to make things work and he won't give the get yet. But broadly speaking, the Aguna situation is a consequence of abusive marriages, and one member of that marriage, generally the husband, being unable and being unwilling to allow the marriage to end and basically allow the wife to actually leave the marriage properly. Most of these situations that talk about the Aguna crisis are correctly talk about the solutions. And that's what we're going to spend 3 weeks on, talking about all the various solutions that have been offered and looking at how compelling they are halachically and why they have either succeeded or failed to gain momentum in the Orthodox community. But today what we're going to focus on is how did it come about? The entire origin of the Aguna crisis is Jewish law's demand for mutual consent to end a marriage. So how did we get into a situation where Jewish law demands mutual consent? Because it's the entire premise upon which the Aguna crisis rests on. And this component of the shiur, I basically gave at Limud Boston a couple of months ago, and where I titled it, The Tragic Irony of Halachic Development, how the Aguna crisis was born from the best of intentions. Because what we're actually going to see is that mutual consent developed as a way to protect women in or leaving marriages, and the tragic irony has become that very medium used to protect women in marriages or exiting marriages has now become the very thing that traps them, requiring mutual consent. So we're gonna see today what we're gonna do is trace the development of divorce law in halacha as it has moved throughout the centuries until we end up with mutual consent, and see another reason why, which exacerbates the Aguna situation. Then what we'll do starting next week is look at various solutions that have been offered. But today we are going to see how halacha developed mutual consent as the way of proceeding in divorces. But before we actually start, we have to adjust our mentalities of marriage, because we all are very fortunate to live in the 21st century, and the 21st century has brought a tremendous amount of wonderful things. And we have, and again, this is a good thing, we have a very different perspective on marriage than most societies have ever had throughout history. In one book, I don't actually recommend reading it because it's like 12 inches thick, but it's Stephanie Kuntz. She's a social anthropologist. It's called Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. Part of the reason you don't read the book is because she tells you everything in the subtitle, which is How Love Conquered Marriage. Nowadays, when we think of marriage, you get married because you love another person. There's really nothing else getting married brings. You don't need to be married in order to have, you know, a role in society, in order to have status in society. One can have a sexual relationship with another person without being married in the eyes of secular law, but one can do that. In society as a whole, marriage is not needed for a great amount of things. You can have economic access to things. Both men and women can have economic access to things without being married. But for most of history, that's not how marriages worked. For most of history in the ancient world, obviously the ancient world in which Jews were a part, marriage is better seen as a partnership. It's a partnership between a man and a woman. Both the man and the woman give to the other person things without the other they would not have. The obvious thing for the man is the ability to have children. You can't do it by yourself. You need someone else. Getting married is convenient because it allows you to have children. But for women, it gave them a sense of agency. They were generally, for most of history, and good thing it's no longer, but for most of history, women were either their father's daughters or their husband's wives. And so you needed to be married in order to have access to wealth, in order to have so much societal, to be situated in society, it was necessary for women to be married, otherwise they didn't really have much. And therefore, it's really important to realize divorces, for the most part, were incredibly undesirable. As we're kind of going to see, it's going to be the premise of so many of these sources, the people who don't want to get divorced are the women. Generally, for most of history, that was the situation. It is not for nothing. If you take a look at source one, it's an incredibly controversial, well-known statement of Chazal. It's repeated in a couple of places. Here's from Ketuvah, Tav Lemetav Tanadu Melametav Armelor. A woman would rather dwell with basically anyone, any man, rather than dwell alone. Some people take great offense at this because it is kind of an offensive statement, especially if you read it prescriptively. But it's descriptive of their situation. The world in which they lived was one in which the vast majority of women, it was advantageous for them to be married. It would be better for a woman to be married than to not be married. Divorces were incredibly undesirable. And it's an important premise to have, because if we take in our 21st century mindset in which marriage is only about love and, you know, women nowadays are equal to men in everything, it makes these rest of these sources so hard to process. And the challenge that halachic figures are addressing throughout most of halachic history don't make sense unless you start with the premise that divorce is undesirable, especially for women, and it's desirable for men, which in the Aguna situation, it's reversed. So that's the premise with which we need to start with in order to understand the rest of the sources. So now, to kind of go through and look at how Jewish law develops over time, its view of divorce. So if you take a look at source number two, there is basically nothing in the Torah that tells us too much about marriage. That's not so surprising, but in Sefer Devarim, in Parashat Ki Tetzeh, we do have the following pasuk. Ki yikach ish isha uv'ala, a man takes a wife and possesses her. V'haya im lo timtzachen be'inav, she doesn't please him. Ki matza ba ervat davar, he finds something unpleasant within her. V'chatav la sefer kritut, v'natan biyada, he writes her a bill of divorcement, gives it to her, v'shilcha mi beta. That is divorce in the Torah, and then he sends her away. It doesn't tell us much, but it tells us a lot. What's the role of the woman in this source? Yeah, non-existent. She is passive. She has no say in this. It's very simple. The husband is married to her. He decides, for whatever reason, he doesn't want to be married to her anymore. That's it. Bye-bye. You are gone. That's it. She is divorced. This is noted by Chazal in source number three. Again, in many places, but in the Gemara Masechet Yevamot, it states, and this is indeed paraphrasing a Mishnah. We're going to see this next week. Eino duma ha'ish ha'megaresh le'isha ha'mitgareshet. The man who divorces is not similar to the woman who is divorced. Shehaisha yotza lirtzona v'shelo lirtzona. The woman is divorced whether she wants to be or not. V'ha'ish eino motzi ela lirtzona. The man is only divorced if he wants to be. Whereas a wife can be divorced against her will, a man can only be divorced if he is willing to be divorced. He holds all the cards in the relationship. He holds all the power in deciding whether or not to be divorced. The woman has none. And again, it's incredibly undesirable for women to be divorced. And so we have this situation. What happens in such a situation with this imbalance is it leaves women in a situation where they can be very quickly destitute. That's the main issue facing women. If you're in a society in which without a husband, it will be very hard to succeed financially, if the husband just kicks you out for no apparent reason one day, that's it. You're gone. You're in an impossible situation. And thus we see the very first instance of an attempt to redress this imbalance, which is the creation of the ketubah. Take a look at source number four. My tamat takinu le rabbanan ketubah. Why did Chazal create the ketubah? Kidei shelo tehei kala be'enav lahotziah. So it's not easy to divorce her. The situation described in the Torah, he can just get rid of her. All of a sudden, the ketubah makes that more difficult. Why? Because it creates a financial responsibility on the husband if he chooses to divorce the wife. There is a tendency in the modern world to have this tremendously romanticized view of the ketubah. And indeed, there are lots of translations of Ketubot, which translate this most beautiful, romantic text, which is not, the Ketubot is an ancient prenup. It's literally, this is the value, this is what you owe, these are the things, you know. It's not particularly exciting, but it's incredibly important, because what it means is that now, if a husband who still can divorce the wife against her will, there is no difference in that situation, but there's one key difference. He now owes money. She will no longer be destitute. He can't just kick her out. He has a financial responsibility to her. And thus, you know, the husband, there's an extra added consideration now. Suddenly divorce becomes slightly less desirable for him because he has to pay for the divorce. He has to give her some money in order to support him. There are obviously situations such as if there is fault. So if the husband wants to divorce the wife because she had an affair, she forfeits the right to the ketubah payment. Likewise, if they do both decide they want a divorce, situations are different. It's not automatically assumed that the money always goes to the wife, but generally, if there is no reason other than the husband's wish to divorce his wife, the ketubah must be paid. This is the first clear and obvious development to grant women greater protections in the marriage. It makes it harder for women to just be kicked out of the marriage. It protects them from this situation happening. In a sense, very little changes, but a lot changes. And there's also further evidence that the ketubah granted greater protections, because Chazal added an extra super important law, which is that you cannot enter a sexual relationship with your wife until the ketubah is signed. The ketubah has to be agreed upon. And what this led to, practically speaking, was it allowed women to insert extra stipulations into their ketubah. So, for instance, in the Cairo Geniza is a vast storehouse of basically, you know, everything from the community there. And there have been many ketubot found, which teach us a tremendous amount of historically fascinating things about how marriage and divorce happened. But they have found ketubot where there are extra stipulations, like against polygamy. It granted a woman, before the marriage began, further opportunities to make certain stipulations, to either prevent divorce in advance, or alternatively to kind of make sure she has a better marriage. So in a community like Cairo, where polygamy was permitted, she could insist, I only want to be the only wife, which is also obviously going to give her a lot more of more power, because again, and we're going to see this shortly with the ultimate solution that happened, but if you can only be married to one woman at a time, again, you really have to seriously think about divorce. In a polygamous culture, divorce happens much lighter because you can just find another wife and, you know, who cares what happens. And so at this point with the creation of the ketubah, you have the disincentivization of divorce at will. And there are halachic authorities, most notably the Shulchan Aruch, for whom this is all that's necessary. The Shulchan Aruch does not suggest anything else is needed in order to protect women in marriage or in exiting marriage. This is enough. By allowing women to insert stipulations and creating the financial disincentive to divorce, that's it. You're good. That is, for the Shulchan Aruch, enough. Obviously, for most of halachic history, by the fact that there are more sources on the sheet than source number four, other halachic authorities take it further. But at this stage, and it's because at this stage, we still have an imbalance. There may be a financial penalty to disincentivize the man. There may be an ability for the woman, before she gets married, to insert extra stipulations. But fundamentally, the husband still holds all of the cards. He decides if they remain married. He decides if she is divorced. She still has no say. And so kind of conceptually, when you're looking at ways to redress this imbalance, when the husband holds all the cards, there's two things you can do. One way is you just give the woman the same cards as the men. You empower women. You give them a situation that allows them to also divorce at will, that allows them to do, you know, that basically gives them exactly the same power as men. Alternatively, the other way is you just take some of the cards away from the man. You disempower men. You make it even harder for them to divorce the wife by creating more and more halachot, more and more rules that govern divorce to such an extent that divorce will not happen as easily. And as we're going to see, different halachic authorities take up different perspectives on this. Some halachic authorities seek to effectively empower women to give them the same cards as men. Alternatively, other halachic authorities seek to disempower men, to make it harder for divorces to happen unilaterally, just by the man deciding himself. Ideally, these would probably work the same way, but in practice, as we're going to see, they are fundamentally different. As in an ideal world, you're redressing the imbalance either way, but practically speaking, that redress changes how divorce actually happens. So the best example of, one of the best examples of an attempt to empower women in divorce comes from the period of the Gaonim. The Gaonim, Gaon is sometimes misunderstood here as genius because of the Vilna Gaon, who for there it means genius. Here it's not an acronym, but it's Gaon means here Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov. They were the Rosh Yeshiva in Bavel, in Iraq, around that entire area, after the close of the Talmud. The best way to explain the period of the Gaonim is simply they were the first people to stop writing in the Gemara itself, in the Talmud itself, and started treating it as a closed text. And the world of Gaonim is fascinating for so many reasons. They are the first people to give us a Siddur, to give us philosophy, to give us poetry. The world of the Gaonim is fascinating, and they were the Rosh Yeshiva of the same yeshivot that Chazal themselves were Rosh Yeshiva of. The world of Gaonim is a fascinating one. There's Robert Brody is a scholar who's kind of an expert. He has a couple of books on the period of the Gaonim. Very fascinating if you want to read more about it. Our source is actually not from the Gaonim themselves, but it's from the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, who is quoting the view of the Gaonim, and he says the following. Source number 5. Ve'imra'u bedorat shehayu acha chachmei ha-gemara b'mei ha-ge'onim zichonam livracha. If you look at the generations that followed the sages of the Gemara, the times of the Ge'onim, b'yeshivot shel Bavel, they were the heads of the yeshivot in Bavel, shehayat zorich sha'a b'meihem. There was a need at the time, lahasiya al divrei Torah, v'lasot geder v'sayag, to reinterpret the words of Torah and to safeguard them. V'tiknu sheyigarish ha'ish et ishto ba'al korcho k'shehi omeret lo ba'inan le'legavre. They decreed that if a woman goes up and says, I no longer wish to be divorced to my husband, he is forced to do so. She can unilaterally divorce her husband. Just as a man can unilaterally divorce his wife, so too can a wife unilaterally divorce his husband. Kedesha lo titala atzma bekuti v'teitzena b'not Yisrael l'tarbut ra'a. So that she not connect herself with the Gentile and the daughters of Israel go in evil ways. I'll explain what that means in a second. V'samchu al zeh, and the Gaonim base themselves on the following rationale. It's a phrase in the Gemara Masechet Ketubot. Kol ha'makadesh ad'ate d'rabat. Kol ha-makadesh ad'ate d'rabanan makadesh. Anyone who gets married is doing so with the consent of the rabbis. V'hiskima da'atam la'hafkiya ha-kiddushin k'shetimrod ha'isha al ba'ala. And thus, if the rabbis give their implicit or, you know, give their clear consent to a marriage, so too they can withdraw their consent. They can annul the marriage. This was the solution proposed by the Gaonim. It's very simple. Women can unilaterally, effectively speaking, can unilaterally, you know, divorce their husbands. And that's done through the process of annulment. You just annul marriages. The Gaonim were trigger happy with annulments, and that's what they did. The reason why is already provided by the Rosh and also kind of verified by history. The main fear was that if women could not find satisfactory reasons to divorce through halacha, through Jewish law, they would go through other systems instead, which the Gaonim were trying to avoid. And so they created this system in order to prevent this problem, which they saw as greater than the issues associated with annulling marriages. It's important to note, and we'll talk about this in future weeks when we look at the solutions, the Rosh here is presenting the view of the Gaonim only to critique it, but we're going to leave that there and discuss that another time. But nonetheless, the first solution, the first way in which halachic figures attempted to redress the imbalance in marriage was very simply give the same cards a man has to the woman. Just as a man can unilaterally divorce his wife, so too can a woman effectively unilaterally divorce her husband. We have a couple of questions Larry and Zoe, and if anyone else has questions too.
When a man divorces a woman, the terms of the ketubah come into play, and assuming all other things being equal, she receives her financial money. When a marriage is annulled, it means it never existed ab initio. Does the ketubah still come into play?
No, there was no marriage.
So therefore she never gets the money that was promised in the ketubah. And if she brought something to the marriage, does it become hers again?
So the finer points of that I don't want to say because I'm not certain. This is not a situation in which the woman needs protecting from. Because she is initiating the divorce. And the ketubah is there to prevent her from being unnecessarily divorced. Again, the historical realities of this are clearly a different point than what I've been saying until now, which is divorce is undesirable. Obviously, there are situations even in this time where women do want a divorce regardless of all else. But you annul the marriage basically never took place. Which is, you know, it's the nuclear option. But nonetheless, one the Gaonim were happy to do. So,
when we say the daughters of Israel go in evil ways and connect themselves with Gentiles, is that as in they'll seek a different court system?
Yes. That's the way. Yeah.
And I guess just following up on that, Shifmer Vaishal Baba, is that also considered, like, if she's rebelling, that's by also using another court system? Or what exactly is that referring to?
Yeah, so something that. The phrase kind of that a woman rebels is the term we see a lot. The kind of the classic sense is woman has an affair, but it seems to be just used as any woman who wants to leave her marriage. That does have greater kind of like connotations of do we assume every woman who wants to leave her marriage to be rebellious? I don't really want to open that Pandora's box, but nonetheless, so whether that's the thing or whether just it's a borrowed term because halacha, you know. Special rabbinic Hebrew tries to have as few as possible specialized terms, which often leads to so much confusion. So, yeah, but in any situation, kishatimrot ha'isha al bala, and we'll see the Rambam use that same phrase. It's just the woman wants the divorce. That's shorthand for it. It doesn't necessarily mean she did something in order to she had an affair to cause fault. Taken off.
Right.
That's exactly what the next 3 weeks are about. Yeah, so kind of what we see here is basically the genesis of all of the solutions can be traced back to the sources on this sheet in some form or another. No one is really attempting to reinvent the wheel here. But yeah, as we'll see, different people throughout modern halachic history have attempted to invoke some of these ideas as a way of solving the Aguna crisis, but for our purposes, we're reading this source today simply as one way to redress the imbalance in divorce in which the husband holds all the cards. Yes,
there's
so.
One more follow-up. Do we have a bunch of these in the Geniza, or is this sort of like, do we have
documents
tracing annulments in the Geniza or elsewhere, or is this more of a theoretical
thing? No, the Gaonim talk about it. Okay. The reason I quoted the Russian part is because Gaonic literature is not as well digitized and horrible to like comb through. But they speak about this a lot. There are plenty of responsa written by Gaonim where they're just like invoking this kind of, I don't want to say they're invoking it left, right, and center, but this is not kind of, oh my goodness, I guess we'll go do it. It seems to be like, yeah, this is how we'll solve the problem. It was obviously a much rarer problem anyway, but this seems to be that go-to solution for solving a situation. You know, the woman doesn't want to be married anymore. Fine, let's just annul it. It's easy.
These are women writing, because I know like part of the Gaonim, especially in Bava, like what they're doing is taking letters in from people who have questions and issuing responses. So this is really that women are writing in to demand this, or is this like?
Yeah.
Saying, I want a divorce.
Yeah, they're responding to a situation in which women are wanting divorces and they're fearful they'll go to other legal systems in order to affect the divorce, and so they're creating this situation in order to resolve it that way.
Okay.
Yeah. Another solution is proposed by the Rambam. The Rambam perhaps often gets a bad rap for not having the most positive views of women, but this source is a very different kind of source than that. And he says the following in his Mishnah Torah, source number 6. Ha'isha shemana bala mitashmish hamita. Hi hanikret moredet. So here we actually get the definition of moredet. I forgot that. He says a woman is simply called, she withholds marital intimacy. She is called a moredet. She's called rebellious. Okay, we won't get into why, but nonetheless. V'sho'alin otom ibnei ma'amarda. We ask her, why are you rebelling? Im amra ma'astihu ve'enei yecholah lehiba'el lo midaati. If she answers, I find him repulsive, and so I can't have relations with him anymore. Kofin oto lish'ato legarsha. The husband is compelled to divorce her immediately. Because she is not a captive, a slave who can be forced to engage in relations with one she loathes. The Rambam here simply says if a woman no longer wants to be married to a husband, she doesn't want to sleep with him anymore because she finds him repulsive, we force him to divorce her. Now, next week we're going to talk a lot about the exact parameters of forcing. But essentially, you know, you can imagine a big stick with a pointy end being the ultimate way we might force him to divorce her. But the fundamental idea here for the Rambam is simply women should not be captives. They cannot be forced to marriages. They cannot be forced to sleep with people they don't want to. They cannot be forced to sleep with people they don't want to sleep with. If a woman wants to be divorced at that very moment, we get the husband, we're like, give her a get. That is once again unilateral on the part of the woman. It's very simple. If she no longer wants to be married, that's it. It's done. It's a very simple way of solving and redressing the imbalance in how marriages are ended in Jewish law. The complete opposite approach, and the approach that is actually accepted by the halachic community, is instead to disempower men, and it's to require mutual consent. The requirement of mutual consent is not the sole aspect here, but it comes from Rabbeinu Gershom. And he is one of the most influential halachists, and at the turn of the 11th century, he convened a council, and they issued several decrees on the Jewish people. And so this is, again, trying to, like, Rabbeinu Gershom is cited by basically everyone, but the cleanest citation is the Encyclopedia Talmudit, which is a modern work. But nonetheless, it says the following: Rabbeinu Gershom me'or hagola hacharim al hanose isha al ishno. He prohibited polygamy, and Rabbeinu Gershom me'or hacharim shalol garish isha shalomi da'ata, and that a man cannot divorce a wife against her will. Her consent is required. Very simply, now no longer can the husband kick out his wife? She has to actually agree to it. She has to say yes. This did, it's important to realize, only affected the Ashkenazi community. For those of you who took part in the Shir on Minhagim, we saw the, I guess it's kind of amusing, but also depressing question sent to the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo Ben Aderet, who was asked by an Ashkenazi guy, if I move to the Sephardi world, can I marry a second wife? To which his answer is, no, that's not how it works. But Rabbeinu Gershom's decrees technically only affected the Ashkenazi community. But both of these, they work in tandem with one another. Because if you're the husband and you just want to kick your wife out, you can't do it. And you also can't just marry a second wife and ignore the first. So polygamy, the ban on polygamy also really forces the man to deal with the situation in front of him, because in theory, if you just banned divorce against the will, fine. If he has the money to support two wives, he can do so. The ban against polygamy really forces the husband to resolve his first marital situation before proceeding to any other marriages he may want to have.
When did Rabbeinu Gershom
live? 11th century. Technically, there are those who point out that his decrees have expired, but nonetheless, also you can't open other people's mail. There's a lot of really interesting decrees he made, but yeah, the main two are the ban on polygamy and the requirement of mutual consent.
Where did he live?
France, Germany area?
Germany,
I forget which one. There you go. I'm glad someone else knows.
Another interesting point is that everybody cites these decrees, but we do not have the original text of any of them.
Yeah, they are all cited by basically everyone else who follows him, but there's no decree letter that we still have and that has these decrees, but they are accepted by basically every single halachist, which also tells you his influence, that he just said something and everyone's like, yep, that's it. But he was deeply influential halachist. So again, this changes the situation, because we still have the ketubah. So the husband still will have to pay his wife the money she is owed, but also she gets to decide if she wants to stay in. And again, remember, divorces are undesirable. So if the woman would rather go back to that first statement of Chazal, a woman would rather be married than not, she can turn around and be like, no, even if you don't want to be married to me, I don't care. This marriage, for whatever reason, is more valuable to me than anything else you can give me. People had a less romantic view of marriage, and women had different status in society. So it's very simple. Very simple for women to now stay in marriages if they want to. And mutual consent. Mutual consent becomes the dominant position. And this is also implicit in the writing, in the gloss of Rav Moshe Isserles, the Ramah, the dominant halachic authority for the Ashkenazi world. The assumption that a woman can refuse to divorce her husband is just implicit within this phrase. Some say that nowadays, since one may not marry two wives, lo mashenan le yud bet chodesh, shemesrei chodesh im rotze le garsha. If the woman doesn't want to accept the divorce, but he wants to divorce her, like how long basically, some say you can wait a period of time basically and then allow him to marry again. V'im eino ratza, matirin lo lisa acheret. V'yesh cholkin she'ein lahatir lo lisa acheret v'chein ikka. But some that disagree, saying no matter what, you can never permit polygamy. He's basically talking about, are there any situations in which we can permit polygamy? To which he says no. But implicit within this is, what's the situation that's causing the polygamy? She says no. He wants to divorce. The situation that Ramah is describing is the husband wants to divorce the wife. She does not want to divorce him. So can there be a period of time where we can say, regardless, let's allow him to marry a second wife? And the Ramah says no. So implicit within that entire framework is a world in which women can refuse divorces. In a world in which that was not possible, this question would never need to be raised. The idea that women can not be divorced against their will is implicit within the Ramah. So there's a lot of, again, technical reasons, some of which we'll touch on perhaps tangentially, as to why this becomes kind of the accepted position. Why mutual consent becomes the accepted position in Jewish divorce. But it's important to realize that it came about in order to redress an imbalance and to grant greater protections to women. And you can also see how, in a world in which divorce is undesirable, this is the best of the solutions. Because in the world of the Rambam and the Gaonim, women can still be divorced against their will. They are just able to also divorce husbands against their will. But it doesn't solve what was a major challenge confronting women at that time, which was being kicked out of marriages when they didn't want to be. And so mutual consent allows women to stay in marriages. They have to consent to the marriage. Fine. If they have to consent to the divorce, sorry. If they don't want to be divorced, they get to stay in the marriage, which was a tremendous empowerment for women for most of halachic history. The problem is that very same power has now come back in the 20th, 21st century to hurt the very women it was once designed to protect. Because now, had halacha developed, either the Gaonic position or the Rambam's position as the way to proceed with divorce, there would be no aguna crisis. Simply, husbands and wives would be able to unilaterally divorce, and there would be no aguna crisis. But by requiring mutual consent, that's the entire premise of the aguna crisis, the very thing that protected women when they lived in a society where they did not, where they were at a disadvantage to be divorced, now hurts women where there is no, you know, issue with women, you know, divorced women have no, or single women have no issues in society nowadays. I mean, okay, some, but by and large, women are at no particular disadvantage in society compared to men, unlike for most of history. And so the main root cause of the Aguna crisis is mutual consent. But there is another component. And this is most forcefully argued by Rabbi Michael Broyd. Rabbi Michael Broyd is a rabbi and also a professor of law at Emory who writes extensively on the Aguna crisis. He actually has a whole book on it, which is kind of a good book to read. A lot of the stuff, you know, comes from his book. His book is a good place to go to kind of learn more about the Aguna situation. And he points to another cause, which exacerbates the Aguna crisis, and that is the disempowerment of Batei Dinim, of Jewish law courts. Take a look at source number 9. So this is the Rambam, Mishnah Torah. Mi shehadin notein shekofin oto legaresh et ishto. If the law requires that a man should be compelled to divorce his wife. So there are plenty of situations where the Beit Din have the power to say, you must divorce your wife. If two parties, to this very day, if two parties come before Beit Din and they explain the situation and Beit Din are like, you are obligated halachically to divorce your wife, what does the Rambam say you do in situation? V'lo ratz halagarish, if the husband doesn't want to, Beit Din shal Yisrael b'chol makom b'chol zman makin oto. They lash him, ad sheyomar rotze ani, until he says, I am willing to do so. So again, we're going to talk next week a bit more about coercion. The Rambam has a very liberal understanding of what counts as coercion in this case. But you beat him senseless until he's willing to say, no, actually, I want to divorce her. Vayichtov haget, and then you write the get. V'hu get kasher, this is a kosher get. He wants to remind us because coercion technically invalidates getin. V'chein im hikuhu akum v'amulo asei masha Yisrael omrim lecha. If the non-Jewish, you know, courts or whatever are beating him too, saying, do what the Jews are telling you to do. V'lachatzu oto Yisrael biyad haka'akum ad sheyigaresh. They exert pressure on him until he gives the divorce. Harei zeh kasher. It's also kosher. This was basically the way Batei Dinim solved situations of igun if they should occur like they do in modern times. It was very simple. You went up to the husband, you're like, either way, she is going to be free to remarry. Either she will be a divorcee or she will be a widow. You choose. But either way, and it was very simple. And this is the thing. Nowadays, thankfully, we live in a world where religious courts cannot just, you know, take you in the middle of the night and beat you senseless until you give the get, and that is illegal, even though there are people who still do that nowadays. That is should never be done, and it's, you know, it is just from the outset. I will state, Ora, if you go to one of those people, Ora will cut you off, by the way. And they will not, it's also a terribly corrupt industry and whatever. We won't get into that, because that's the solution of the Aguna crisis we're not going to talk about. But nonetheless, but back classically, that's what they did. And if you take a look at, in source 10, the Aruch HaShulchan, this is a much more modern work. This is the late 19th century. The Aruch HaShulchan is one of two halachic figures to write a complete code on every aspect of Jewish law. Him and the Rambam are the only two people to ever do so. The Aruch HaShulchan writes, V'ketzad osin shehadin noten shemiyuchav legaresh, ve'eno yadenu tekifa lekofo, v'tzurichin lekofo al yedei archaot. We compel him using the power of non-Jewish courts. It's important to realize that archaot here, that's a trigger word, because one of the great sins one can do as a Jew is use the secular legal system. If you want to see, you know, in part the need to solve this crisis, you see the Aruch HaShulchan had to do so, but it's more than that, because again, in his day, he lived in Russia, the Russian government too had big sticks with pointy ends. They're not, you know, going to some nice court where there's going to be some nice proceedings. Again, he's going to be led into a dark room and beaten senseless. And again, this was the solution. If the man divorced and if the woman wanted a divorce, the man didn't want a divorce, it was very simple. She got the divorce no matter what. Nowadays, it's a good thing Batei Dinim no longer have that power, but in general, people aren't allowed to take the law into their own hands. But a side product of that disempowerment of basically everyone who's not an official representative of the state, and even representatives of the states are limited in what they can do, that has created a further disempowerment of Batei Dinim. Also, if you take a look at source number 11, another example of how a Beit Din with power might, you know, make sure a woman gets her get. So this is quoted in the Pitchei Teshuva, but he's quoting the Beit Meir, Rabbi Meir ben Rabbi Yehuda Leib Posner. He's a Polish-German rabbi, a major halachist in the 1700s, And he writes the following. Lachein hamutav lafi ani estaiti shelo lekafuto al haget. It's better not to force the husband to give the get. I'm assuming here he means with pointy sticks. Ki im alachiyuv mezonot uparnasa, but rather to demand this the support payment, all the tashlumim hanadunya v'haketuva, or alternatively you enforce the payments of the ketubah or other kinds of reimbursements and dowry. Ad shemikoach zeh, and then this is a really weird phrase. Ba'al korcha yeratza atzmo leget. He will willingly give the get. Al yidei pishara katzat, as its small compromise. Ubazeh ein shum chashash. And through this, there's no concern. The Beit Meir suggests, and many others do too, through to the modern day, that fine, you can't beat people senseless anymore for a lot of reasons. But nonetheless, he has to pay. He has to pay up. This is indeed how the halachic prenup works on the same premise. We'll talk about that in the final week. But the idea is what Bati Dinim used to be able to do was fine you. They would make you pay. They could, and you know, for that reason, the husband's like, fine, you can refuse to give the get, but now you are obligated to pay all this money. But again, in a world in which Bati Dinim don't have power, and again, the halachic prenup works because it's then a binding arbitration agreement that can be enforced by the courts. But if you don't have that, Bate Dinam are limited in their ability to enforce monetary payments nowadays. They can't just, a Beit Din can't just say, oh, you have to, you owe, you know, $10,000. It's very easily disputable. And so for another reason, Bate Dinam used to be able to fine. They used to be able to financially impose obligations upon the husband, which again would force him to give the get. But again, with the disempowerment of Bate Dinam, this has created and further exacerbated the solutions to the Aguna crisis. And there is basically only one solution left. And take a look at source number 12. So this is Rabbeinu Tam in Sefer HaYashar. He writes the following. Tigzeruba ela chamura al kol ish ve'isha mizera beit Yisrael hanilvim aleichem, a decree upon everyone in your jurisdiction. Talking about a guy who won't, you know, give his wife a get. Shelo yehu rishayin ledava imo. Lisa velitein imo laharicho v'ha'ola ha'achilo ola hashkoto ola lalvoto v'liv koro b'chaloto. You are not allowed to speak to this person. The Jewish community should not speak to him, host him, feed him, give him anything to drink, accompany him, visit him when he is ill. V'od yosifu choma b'rtonam al kol adam im lo yigaresh v'yater oto ha'ish et ha... Yalda Hazot. If he still refuses to divorce her, you can continue to heap on these things. It's communal pressure. It's excommunication. And to this day, this is still done. And if you take a look at what's being handed around, you will see a ruling by the Beit Din of America, which says this very thing. I'll wait a few moments for it to be passed down. But in a world in which Bate Dinim have no other official legal empowerment, their one empowerment left is communal. So these are all public, and the Oru website kind of, you know, points these things out. Basically, just a brief history of the Beit Din of America. Brief history of the Beit Din of America, but let's say you want to get divorced through the Beit Din of America, you go to the Beit Din of America, you give them your husband's details, they will send him a summons. If he ignores that summons, they'll send him a second summons. And I believe they'll even send a third. They're a very nice Beit Din. After that, they will send you a warning, that you are going to be, treated, more seriously as misarev lavoladin, as someone who's basically been held in contempt of court. If you ignore that 2 weeks later again, these are all like, I think on a 2 week cycle, they will send you another warning that this will be about to happen. And finally, they will do so. If you are considered Masarev Levolavit Leladin, held in contempt, there are already certain basically excommunicatory measures held against you. But finally, if they have decided actually you do need to give the get and you're refusing to do that, you get letters like the following. In a psak, in a decision issued by a panel of the Beit Din of America on October 30th, 2014, regarding a request by Ms. Leah Chowai for a get from her husband, Mr. Yechiel Friedman, in the pantheon of awful people refusing to give a get. He sits quite high in that pantheon, by the way. The panel found that Mr. Friedman should give a get, but no later than 21st of November. To date, no get has been given. Therefore, in accordance with Jewish law, it is proper and appropriate that members of the Jewish community abide by the Harchakot Rabbeinu Tam, prescribed by Jewish law in situations such as these, as set for in basically everything. These Harchakot may include the following restrictions exercisable by the community in expression of their voluntary religious choice. By the way, you see within that legal language the very fact that they cannot compel people to do anything. So it's the community as an expression of their voluntary religious choice, because the Beit of America does not have power unless you sign an agreement in advance to give them power. They don't have power over people. In the olden days, Bati Dinim had power over people. They could tell, they said jump, everyone else said how high. Nowadays they can't. So still people can voluntarily follow the rules they are issuing. There's very clever legal language in all the things of the Bati Dinim of America. They are also very often lawyers who write very clever legal language to make sure they aren't violating any, you know, legal issues in America. Members of the Jewish community should not speak to Mr. Friedman other than when absolutely necessary. Members of the Jewish community should decline to host him in their homes or to provide him with food or drink, invite him to parties, or otherwise socialize with him. Jewish communal institutions, including synagogues, should adopt the following sanctions against him. He not be permitted to occupy any elective position, nor be an employee. He be excluded from membership. He not be given any honor or recognition, nor be allowed to participate, and that his name be announced on a regular monthly basis, published in the bulletin, with respect to his refusal to give his wife a get, calling on the members to kind of effectively excommunicate him. There is, I forget which one of the major Jewish newspapers in the New York, New Jersey area has basically a running advert of all the people, Jewish press, a running advert of all the people refusing to give gittin. But the fact is, and you know, there was a famous video went viral. It was the now former head of Ora spotted. I think it was Yechiel Friedman trying to catch a minion in NYU. And he was basically shouting at him to leave because of all the places people are going to be sympathetic. It's the place where basically every single name at the top of this Beit Din of America is either also a rabbi at YU or a graduate of YU. So, you know, those are the kind of, why he was there in the first place is unclear. But nonetheless, basically, you excommunicate, and, you know, were a situation, you know, in the shul, you know, hopefully it would never happen, were there to be a, you know, ma'agen, a recalcitrant husband in the shul, like I would expect most of my rabbinic colleagues, it would be announced. It would be made sure this person does not count towards the minyan. This person cannot receive an aliyah. It's excommunication. The problem is with this method of excommunication is that as powerful as it is, it only works in a limited number of situations. For when you look kind of at the Aguna situation, at the Aguna crisis, and we're going to start talking about this in more detail next week, there's kind of a reverse bell curve if you look at kind of the Jewish spectrum. If you kind of position the modern Orthodox community somewhat in the middle, it is less of an issue nowadays, in part because of the halachic prenup, which we'll talk about in the fourth week, but also because of communal pressure. And when we lived in Highland Park, New Jersey, also a member of the shul was a guy whose brother was refusing to give his wife a get. We were once at the same meal, to which someone turned around and was like, Mark, how's it going working at Ora? And I'm like, don't talk. Someone else who lived in Highland Park was the actual caseworker dealing with that case, which also led to a lot of awkward social situations. But there is, it's not to say it has been solved, because it has been far from solved in the modern Orthodox world, but the communal pressure exists. The problem is, either say in the more Haredi and Hasidic communities, which are less concerned by certain things, or that communal pressure works in other ways, or alternatively, as is often the case, the person refusing to give the get isn't religious, or alternatively has moved to a part of the world where they are no longer part of the Orthodox community, and then these sanctions matter nothing. The number of recalcitrant husbands who move to Vegas, part of this is because Nevada will not extradite, I don't know if that's the correct word, but Nevada will not extradite anyone being held, you know, liable by a court in any other state. Very often these men are also kind of, you know, not giving alimony, not giving, you know, child support, not giving all these things they're supposed to be doing. They are very often being, you know, they are wanted. And sometimes by the courts themselves, if you go to Nevada, you're safe. Las Vegas is actually a haven. And if you are a ma'agen, a recalcitrant husband, which is, you know, another thing to stop off on your touring of Las Vegas. It's probably not on the bright strip, but nonetheless, there's even a guy who, like, has his own shul for all these people who are recalcitrant husbands. If you go there, you know, they don't enforce the Harchak or Dorabenu Tam in a shocking turn of events. They don't really care for the Beit Din of America. Alternatively, if you're just kind of an irreligious Jew, either, again, it doesn't just affect the Orthodox community. If you don't care for the Harchak or Dorabenu Tam for whatever reason, or you don't live in the Jewish community, as is very often the case, these sanctions are, again, meaningless. And so the Aguna crisis is born, as hopefully what everyone's seen before we start looking at the various solutions starting next week. The Aguna crisis is born from two major changes in how halacha has functioned. The first is the tragic irony that halacha developed the law of mutual consent originally to protect women for whom leaving a marriage was undesirable, and that very same protection now harms women because they are unable to leave those marriages. But second, even in a world of mutual consent, if the Beit Din had the power to enforce its rulings upon people, even in a world of mutual consent, it doesn't matter, because, you know, the other way is, even if the husband says no, if the Beit Din says you are halakhically obligated to give a get, it doesn't matter what he thinks. We can force him to give the get in some way or another, but if we can't force him to give the get, which is a good development in society, the Bati Dinim can't just start beating people up randomly, but nonetheless, even the financial penalties, even the communal pressure, these things can only work so far. And so it's these two issues in tandem really exacerbate the situation and create a world in which the Aguna crisis kind of thrives. And as we're going to start looking at next week, various solutions have been proposed in the recent past in order to try and stop situations of Aguna from being created, and also to resolve those women who are currently Agunot.